will be Pod, a 32 Fans podcast where we discuss all things movies, past, present, and occasionally future. My name is Sammy Chester.
And I'm Will from America.
And I'm Obsonensky.
Today we're going to be talking about the many new movies of July 2020 as we are going on the 6th month in a global pandemic now.
Fine months for movies.
We're going to talk about some recent watches and do a deep dive into, I almost said Staten Island, Palm Springs.
There was a big movie by Chris Nolan out this month, wasn't there?
I think there was supposed to be.
Yeah, but we're going to give Palm Springs our feature instead of Chris Nolan's big tempo movie. So I think that's deserving. I think we have a number of special guests joining us. There's even a theme.
Yes, I guess. We sure do. And given that it's July, the theme is, of course, brothers, as is the case for July. Everyone knows that. We have today the brother of our co-host, Sammy Chester. That's his brother, Shy, Dr. Chester, who will join us later to speak about the science behind Palm Springs. And we also have the brother of my co-host from the Movie Ladder, Zach Brooks. This is his brother, Aaron Brooks, who returns to There Will Be Pod for the second time. And he'll be joining us for some of the recent watches and Classic Corner. So we're excited to have both of them.
What are the chances we will get the brother of Av or the brother of Will from America in a future episode?
If you can track down a brother of mine, then we will have him on the podcast. Absolutely.
Yeah, my brother's still 13, so I don't know how much his attention span will really favor podcasting.
Okay, so in both cases, slim. Will, maybe your brother won't join us, but I think you should be able to join us with a few quick hits of movies you saw in July or movies that came out recently that you saw in the last few weeks. What did you really like? What did you dislike? Give us your hits and misses.
Yeah, so, you know, I didn't really like or dislike anything this month. Ooh. I saw a lot of stuff that was very okay. So the first one of those was The King of Staten Island, which I alluded to earlier, starring Pete Davidson. It's a brisk 2 hours and 17 minutes long, directed by Judd Apatow.
Sounds like a comedy. You got Apatow, yep, you got Pete Davidson.
Yep. Yeah, it's sort of like a comedic drama, but it's kind of a semi-autobiographical look at Pete Davidson's life. And, you know, it was pretty okay.
Would you say this is what 7 Days in Hell was for Andy Samberg? This will be for Pete Davidson in terms of his film career?
I feel like this will probably be remembered a bit more. I don't think anyone really talks about 7 Days in Hell very much.
Oh, they should. I think it's Sandberg's best movie, but putting that aside.
I think that's a better movie than this one.
Nice.
But okay. I also think this one has more popular.
So this is a movie you're recommending this, Will, or you're disrecommending this?
I'm not recommending it.
I happily skipped this.
You didn't miss much.
No, I missed 2.5 hours. I missed a lot.
Fair. You didn't miss.
You might say
much.
You retained 2.5 hours.
Yeah. Aaron, yeah. Aaron, you got to get in on this. We didn't give Aaron a chance to respond when we introduced him.
Yeah. If you liked any movies this month,
if you liked a June movie about Pete Davidson, you got to get in there and, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I've been a fan of both Pete Davidson movies that came out this year, actually. So I'm on a lonely island here.
Nice.
Thank you. I had a really good time with this movie, actually. I really unfortunately did respond quite a bit and do respond quite a bit to Pete Davidson's comedic style and just overall a lot of his overall comedic sensibilities. And they're all here. It's a very Judd Apatow movie as well. If you've skipped it, you don't need to go to it.
Who should look out for it? What kind of fan will like the movie?
I think a fan of, like, it's pretty consistent with a lot of Judd Apatow's recent work. If a lot of his recent work's been grading, I've been liking it. I liked down to, like, Love on Netflix. I really appreciate that series and that. No, I don't know anybody else who liked that. But I think that the supporting performances are what are particularly noteworthy. I really thought Bill Burr and Marissa Tomei were outstanding. And if it was like a little cooler to like Pete Davidson, they more, I think people would be giving those performances credit, but people don't quite want to, you know, give this movie that credit in my
opinion. I saw somewhere they said they'll watch the movie when the edited version that only shows Marissa Tomei's scenes, when that clipped down edited version comes up, that's the version they would recommend people to see. So I don't know how long that would be because I didn't see the movie, but I would get in line for that. But yeah, otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, Pete Davidson wasn't bad. You know, he was just playing the same character he always plays, right? And I think it's just getting a little tired out at this point.
Yeah, yeah. I can see that argument for sure.
So Will or Aaron, give us something. It doesn't sound like Will is anything he's more passionate about. But Aaron, do you have something you're much more passionate about from this month?
I really, really am a big fan of a movie that I haven't seen enough love for. But when I've talked to people who have seen it, they've seemed to respond pretty strongly to it. And that's Archive, directed by and written by Gavin Rothery, I believe. I believe this is his debut as well, starring Theo James, who I particularly really liked in this role. I just thought this was a really cool, very lived in sci-fi movie that I was surprised at the quality of the work in, and it just kind of came out of nowhere for me. I turned it on one day, not expecting.
Aaron, I thought I'd get credit for recommending this movie to you. Did I, or you already had it on your watch
list? I had already had it on my watch list when you had came to me, but you kind of gave, after I talked to you, I immediately watched it, but still, I don't necessarily think our film tastes always line up from the last time I was on here and talking to you, so I was like, we'll see, but I went into it, it really reminded me of the best possible episode of Love, Death, and Robots, if you've seen any of that, which I'm not saying any of those are great, but this was really just like a good adult sci-fi story to me with just, I really appreciated it.
Let me jump on this a bit because I really like this movie and I think all four of us saw this. This and Hamilton might be the two, and I guess First Cow, we'll get to that, but these are maybe the movies we've all seen. I really, really liked Archive. And what I would say is the part of it I like the least and the part I wish was not in the movie, and I'd love to get your take, and let's leave it spoiler-free, Aaron and the other guys, was the ending. I think the ending is completely unnecessary. And
I agree.
I wish the movie just did without it, because I think what the movie does really well is, to me, it's a mashup of Frankenstein, The Singularity, which people can Google if they're not nerds and they don't know what that means, video game aesthetic, plus really good interplay between characters that are robots, characters that are living in a memory system, and real-life character. And finally, I would say references to sci-fi movies of the past. I mean, 2001, the director's own movie that he helped sort of as a second director on, Moon, and, a number of other sci-fi movies are directly referenced. In a passionate way. So Frankenstein, Singularity, video games, great character interaction, and call outs to some of the greatest sci-fi movies of the past. I thought that a great score and just beautiful visuals, very unique.
Yeah.
To me, that made a memorable movie that I could have done without the last 5 minutes.
Yeah, I would even go so far to say is that it was hard for me to then go back and think about what is even happening in this movie in light of the ending. And again, obviously I don't want to spoil anything, but it kind of just felt as the movie was kind of broken off from the rest of the movie.
Yeah. But because you weren't crazy about the movie, as I recall. If what I'm recommending, would that make you appreciate the movie more if it didn't have the ending?
No, I mean, I enjoyed the movie. I didn't love it. I just felt like I've seen this movie before. Not to say that this wasn't well done. It just seems like, to me, it didn't really advance from, other AI type movies or certain episodes of Black Mirror that just felt very similar. There's one episode in particular that seems very of the same world as this. And I thought that those other movies that I enjoyed were probably better than this one. So it kind of was just a little bit rote and just didn't advance the ball to me. But that's not to say this wasn't well made and didn't have anything going for it.
Yeah,
it's definitely a movie struggling to find its own identity. And I believe the director of this was also the set designer for Moon, which is another movie I've seen get a lot of comparisons to from this. I agree with Sammy about like the music, the how the film looked was all really well done. I wouldn't really say that I enjoyed Theo James's performance very much. I think he was sort of sleepwalking through the movie at points. I've not really been impressed by anything I've seen him in. He was in like the Divergent series, which
he is so much better here than the Divergent series. Divergent series is not expecting much from him, but
but
he was kind of I thought he played sort of selfish asshole the way he sort of, the way his relationship with the second robot with J2, he's sort of dismissive and, you know, doesn't.
Yeah. I liked the stuff with J2. I wish that, I guess not to give spoilers, but I wish that would have went more places than it did. It sort of just got, that plot thread was sort of dropped.
Yeah. J1 and J2 were my favorite parts of the movie.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I really like J1. I love like the very last, one of the last scenes with J1 that really moved me. I was moved by the second two acts of this movie again. And my third act doesn't include the last 5 minutes. I was very moved. And I think I mentioned this to you guys, the first act of this movie, I was like, wow, this could be the best video game cutscene I've ever seen. And I'm like one of the nerds who, I love just watching video game cinematics. So
I agree.
I think the director also has a background in that. You know, the lady who plays the boss, the sort of bitchy boss in this movie, she's the like the face and the body role model for Lara Croft. Like in all the Lara Croft video games, they were based around her. That she's a model in real life. So, you know, I think there's an intentional video game aesthetic on multiple levels.
And I'm a huge gamer, and I appreciate when it's genuinely done, like in this movie. So
the biggest reason I didn't connect with this movie as much, I think I'm just getting tired of the whole, no one can make a movie about artificial intelligence without a factor being like, but can I put my dick in it?
Yep.
Like, that seems to be that all... like male filmmakers are interested in telling stories about AI. It's just like, can I have sex with it?
But to me, I mean, I really don't think that can I have sex with it. I understand that besides the singularity and, you know, can robots think like humans, there's the whole element of, you know, can my loved one come back to me? Which, you know, on some level ultimately leads to, and then can I have sex with the robot, I suppose. So I'll give you that. But to me, it's much more foregrounded the, you know, can I have an emotional interaction with the robot? You know, can I have an intellectual interaction with the robot? Will all that be meaningful? So I don't have that concern, though, you know, I'm sympathetic, I guess, to what you're saying. I'll leave this on archive, which is, it came out of nowhere for me. Like, I forget where it was recommended to me, but it really came out of nowhere. It was up there as one of the movies I most liked this year. I think Assistant still has the top spot because Assistant is just sort of a jewel of a movie where everything really works. And the messed up ending here sort of takes a bit away. Plus, this is, I think we should warn people, and Av, I think you'll concur, this is a slow burn of a movie.
Oh, yes.
The first half is a slow burn, and it takes its time, and it's slowly like kind of unwrapping layers and showing you how the internal semiconductor of a computer, you know, as you're sort of rushing through it. This movie is taking its time, and that might not be for everyone. I think it'd be for most listeners, though. I'll leave off with one thing. My role day to day is I invest in startups, and I can't tell you how many startups I meet who are working on conversational AI and machine learning and emotional, you know, everything basically that this movie is actively advancing. That is what, you know, startups are working on all the time, technology companies working on all the time. And even to the extent, right when this movie came out, there was a major release, literally the GPT-3, the third edition of a nonprofit founded by Elon Musk called OpenAI. And OpenAI is trying to develop the first breakthrough in conversational AI, you know, effectively, again, the singularity. And I just thought it was kind of fun that OpenAI released their sort of groundbreaking third iteration the same week that Archive arrived to us with J1, J2, and J3. So this stuff is really happening, and it wasn't such a, you know, tremendous jump into the future. It's one of those things where so many sci-fi movies do really inform the direction, and they have this kind of fun conversation with what is being invented at the same time. And to me, even as this movie was somewhat iterative of things we've seen before, at the same time, I think it is advancing that process. So that's another thing I really liked about it. I would jump down on Aaron and recommend it wholeheartedly. But yeah, I think Aaron, you're right that Toby Jones has a role in Archive. And he also has a role in another movie that I know you love.
Indeed. And you've also brought up that you worked with startups. So I'm definitely interested to hear what you think about this movie. Because this is definitely like a startup movie.
No way. So, it's such a bullshit narrative. Oh, I can't stand that narrative.
I'm only like 75% kidding with that one. But that's First Cow, directed by Kelly Reichardt.
Let's do a quick, Eric, can we do a quick survey of the
Reichardt call. Sure, Reichardt.
Which of the, I think we've all of us have seen at least two Reichardt movies. Is that fair?
I have seen Wendy and Lucy and Meek's Cutoff and Certain Women. So I've seen three before the First Cow.
So I've seen two. Will, have you seen any besides First Cow?
I'd never even heard of any of her movies. I looked at her filmography after watching First Cow, and I feel like a real fake fan now.
Nope. Wendy and Lucy is extremely highly regarded. It was on it's really good. The New York Times did, like, a few years ago, their film critics did, like, the best 25 movies of the century so far, and Wendy and Lucy was on that list.
Well, I'm definitely going to watch this now.
Critics love Reichardt. I mean, First Cow is far and away the number one movie of the year so far. I just, Aaron, before you go in, and you should gush about the movie a bit more, I just felt it was nice to have round robin, because you can speak to this more than the other three of us, because I think you've seen the most of her movies. Reichardt has a very distinct style, and I would count myself as someone who doesn't really work, who her style doesn't really work for me. I can respect it, but I won't, it doesn't engage me. And I don't know if Av and Will, or maybe Av at least, how much her style engages you.
Her style can be tough. I mean, her movies are very deliberately paced. So, you know, for someone who, you know, needs any sort of like ongoing action, like, you're going to probably turn this movie off after 20 minutes. But I think there is definitely a good amount to appreciate here. And, you know, if you stick with it, I think it pays off in certain respects, although it never really picks up action wise.
No, it definitely, there is no argument there for me. The milk is worth the squeeze, though, I'm telling you, with this one, because it definitely is a Reichardt movie. She's so authentically herself with all of her films. I've seen her entire filmography. My personal favorite is actually Old Joy, which is a gorgeous, gorgeous movie that I think will only, I'll only increase like my love for it with as I age in my own life, because I think a lot of the things that are dealt with in it, I'm nowhere near dealing with yet, but Old Joy. This reminded me a lot of that. The pace is not quick.
Aaron, what is this movie about? Both sort of a one sentence plot summary, and more so, what are the themes that you think this movie is about? Because critics are loving this movie for its themes. No one loves this movie for its plot.
It's about a bull who gets elected president, and this is his wife.
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly. Basically, it's about two people who are who don't have, you know, anything in common yet, come together for a goal.
It's about friendship in the Oregon Territory. It's about a friendship between two guys in the Oregon Territory.
I mean, it's about a friendship. It's about a startup, in the 1820s. It's about changes in culture and changes in traditions and what is ethics. I think it's about business ethics. As a business person myself, I see a lot of, you know, quandaries I deal with in my own line of work as well. So I just think it's I don't think it's meant to have action. I think you're meant to kind of just live in this world, and I think the colors are refreshing during a time of quarantine, especially when getting outside, going into nature, for me at least in Washington DC, is very difficult. To see all these greens and hear nature and just like breaking of sticks underneath the wheel, it's a really simple, slow paced movie.
How many mushrooms did you need to see being slowly tasted and snapped off the ground? I was done after one.
You know, I mean, it. I can say the same thing about like Chef or something that everybody can love and say, how many like little fish tacos do I have to watch being consumed by Jon Favreau or something? At least this movie stuck to its themes throughout to the conclusion, even if the conclusion wasn't as satisfying.
Aaron, I would say something kind of, you know, about the Toby Jones duality that we have between our, because he's in both Archive and First Cow, similar roles in both, I would say, in the sense of sort of like a minor role of some authority that kind of shows up in his own way. And that is, in the same way I think Archive is a better movie without the last 5 minutes, I think First Cow is a better movie without the first 5 minutes. I don't think that first scene set today adds anything whatsoever to the movie. And not that the movie needed a suspense ending, but knowing exactly how the story is going to end takes the very, very small scintillator of plot suspense completely away from the movie. I think the beginning, again, I would tell viewers it's a slow burn either way. Like, just start the movie 10 minutes in.
Well, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say that, but I agree with what you're saying. But yeah, I mean, it's I think it does a good job of kind of like deconstructing like American mythology, especially around the American dream. You know, this notion that like it was people who like moved out west with nothing but like their, you know, backpack and hard work and grit. And, you know, that's how you make it in America. And really how you make it in America is by tricking people and scamming them.
Yep.
I saw a lot of, you know, again, this is a critically loved movie, so it's getting a ton of attention in podcasts and blogs and, you know, proper reviews everywhere. I mean, not proper reviews, reviews. And people love it, again, for its themes. And I don't know, I just don't buy into all these narratives. It's not a movie about a startup. It's not a movie about business ethics. I agree with what Av is saying to some extent. You know, it shows sort of some of the scamminess. But, like, I don't get it. Like, these guys were stealing milk. You know, they were basically thieves. They were thieves and were meant to be sympathetic with them. I didn't feel any sympathy to them whatsoever.
Sammy, any movie is about what you want it to be about.
I mean, the plot is so straightforward. These guys are stealing milk to make a buck off someone else. And because that they're soft, sweet, and timid, we're supposed to see them as the heroes. But I don't know. I mean, like I was rooting for them to be arrested the whole movie.
But that's only because you knew that they're thieves. I mean, I think that's kind of the point, is that, like, right, to the outsiders, everyone else who's in this world will view these as just, like, successful business entrepreneurs who, you know, use their wits and came up with a business idea, and that's how they're going to become successful. But we're
the audience.
We know the truth. So I think it's just kind of giving us an inside view of kind of, like, pulling back the curtain and showing this is how it's really done.
Exactly. I agree 100%. I don't think at all that she has an intention of viewing them as heroes or villains or any of that's your interpretation, you're right to, but I didn't at all feel that way, and I kind of did feel conflicted, but yet wanted to root for them, but I didn't. But this is how businesses are. I mean, you look underneath, you know, the underbelly of any of these businesses, and they have much worse things than stealing milk from a cow, probably.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, people say that as well. And, you know, I'm by no means an expert on businesses, but like I'm every single day meeting with entrepreneurs who are working 24 hours a day to do things, and they're not stealing. They're not building their business on thievery and cutting corners. And I know the Amazons and the Microsofts and the Googles and Nike with its stores in Thailand. And like, there's no shortage of business scams and inappropriate activities, but I don't sign on to this idea that, you know, ultimately capitalism is based upon cheating the other guy.
I don't want to jump too far into it because I know this is a short podcast, but those phones that all your business startups are working on, did they make those phones with all the like materials in them that aren't mined from a certain area of the world or anything like that? Like there's a stolen milk to everything in life, including how we're able to podcast here right now.
I wouldn't go so far. I mean, yeah, look, if you want to like tie every string into the world, okay, but it's much different to say that this string is connected to that string, which is connected to that string, versus I myself am the one committing the crime directly. Yeah, I mean, like indirectly, the world's a complicated place, but direct, you know. But, you know, we can maybe agree to disagree at this point, and and we'll let another movie in a future month give us a platform to debate this further. Were there any other kind of notable movies that Will or Aaron, you guys want to give some love or some hate?
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't really necessarily a movie, but Hamilton was released on Disney Plus.
Oh, was it?
Yeah. I don't know if you heard, if you saw any tweets.
Did you see that movie yet this month?
Yeah, I saw it a few times.
How many times?
Yeah, I should have had my brother come on to talk about this, actually, because he's watched it 6 times.
Wow. Was he waiting desperately for it to come out on Disney?
Oh, yeah, he was.
Nice. I don't know that I've actually watched it beginning to end more than once. Me and my wife sat down to watch it. She fell asleep halfway through and I finished it. Then we tried again the next night. We started from the beginning of the second act. She fell asleep, you know, halfway through that and I finished it. And then we did it a third time until she had seen the whole thing. And then I've watched parts of it with my kids several times. And, you know, there are certain songs that I've probably watched 20 times.
I'm with Team Will. I think Hamilton is amazing, and this was really great fun, and you know, it's in my, I think it's not my ninth favorite thing I've watched this year as a movie. I wouldn't consider this a movie. I think it was a well-shot theater play, and that's it. And you know, and again, I think there was a way it could have been shot that would have made it a cinematic experience. Again, it was well shot, but it was, as Av, I think you said in the podcast you did on this, it was shot as if we had like the best seat in the house. Aaron, who is someone who I respect, as you know, who has a better sense of movies in certain ways, I think there's a level of camera that could have pushed this into the sphere of it being cinema and a movie and a film versus we're getting to see a great play. And to me, it was we're getting to see a great play.
Yeah, well, I can pretty much guarantee you that you're going to get to see the other version of it at some point. It's only a matter of time.
There will be a movie.
I would say. Yeah, there will be a movie. But yeah, I mean, I as I said on our Movie Ladder podcast, I thought this was both simultaneously an incredible entry point for someone who's never seen the show before, just made it as accessible as ever between subtitles and close-ups. And it was also just for a super fan, just like a dream come true to be able to just like have access to this whenever I want.
Yeah, so I'd seen Hamilton live. I saw it a couple years ago, like when it started touring. I literally the back row of the theater, so I could barely make out what was going on. So this was a much better experience than that, I would say. You know, there's a difference between seeing something live and seeing something like a live performance filmed. And I know a lot of people have said like this doesn't really live up to the hype. But I feel like that's a vocal minority.
Yeah. So three things I want to throw quickly. One, I've said this on again, the previous pod, so I'll just leave it at that. Miranda to me is just so much less charming and charismatic and singing ability than everyone else next to him that yeah. it's just strange because the play is called Hamilton and he is the driving protagonist as much as he does give, you know, the stage to his colleagues at times. And yet it does something to the performance in as any, you know, work would, when the lead in a work is not really as dynamic and yet he is the protagonist. I think it does sort of weaken the whole work as a whole. Again, despite the incredible, I mean, he is, you know, the reason this exists. But to me, that's a minus. And a better Hamilton, I think, would make it a better performance. But, you know, I know, Av, you've sort of agreed with that, at least in part. So we don't have to belabor the point.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. He's not a great performer compared to these other people who are world-class Broadway performers. He's a, not just world-class, like in the history of the world, he's like an all-time great creator of art, but he's not a performer. He doesn't have a great singing voice. I think he does add some nuance in some of his like facial reactions that maybe others don't necessarily have as much because like it's not as intimate for them as it is for him. I mean, this is like in a lot of ways his own story. Like he has talked extensively about how much he just related to Alexander Hamilton's story as, you know, somebody from the Caribbean who came here with just like the gift of gab and ability to just like pull himself up by his power of the written word. But yeah, he's not the best, you know, he's probably like the 20th best performer in this, yeah, in this show.
Two quick questions for you guys. One is, to what extent are sort of fans or arguably even super fans of Hamilton people who just aren't familiar with musicals very much? So here, when they see a pop culturally popular musical, they go, wow, musicals are really showy and look at all the cool stuff going on the stage. And I'm not from New York. I haven't seen that many musicals. I've probably seen five in my life, but like, that's what musicals are like. And some of the buzz and excitement I hear from sort of fans of Hamilton, some of it I go like, yeah, that's what musicals are good at doing. They're good at having like cool stage elements and people moving off and people moving in. And that scene toward the very end of Hamilton when the woman sort of traces the bullet, I've seen things like that in other stage plays, and they're really cool and they're cool the way they do that. But there was nothing in the kind of showiness of a musical that I felt Hamilton, again, not talking about the script or the songs, does in any way extraordinary. And if anything, again, I've seen musicals where they've really taken it into a new direction. So that's one thing. And maybe just you can answer both my questions. And my second and last one is, how much of the charm of Hamilton is the conceit of having minorities in the roles of these like old white guy founders, and they're using rap and R&B and whatnot, rather than the quality of the actual songs.
I mean, I think that Hamilton personally would work just as well if it wasn't based on historical events. Like sometimes when I'm watching it, I forget that all of this stuff really happened because it's very dramatized, you know? And it feels like separate from history in a way.
Because you can watch someone named George Washington and not think about America.
Well, they're not constantly saying, "Hey, George Washington," you know. It's like you can kind of forget that that's who the character is.
To Will's point, like one of my favorite moments of the musical is in Yorktown at the very end, where like the three or four main like characters that we get to know are just like standing on platforms and just they each shout one after another, "We won," because like there's like a certain in our minds, there's a certain inevitability to the American Revolution. Like, of course, America wins because it's America, which was like completely ridiculous at the time that this like these colonies would defeat the most powerful army in the world. And it just, I think it just like puts it in like such a, like every time we get to that, like I like pump my fist, like we won, like as if like we just won like this like great contest that, you know, in our heads, of course we won because, you know, where are we and what does America represent in the world today? But it just like adds, just kind of puts you in the moment in a way.
So you, you would reject what I'm saying? You're saying the charm of the movie is not, the charm of the play, the movie, whatever you call it, is not mainly this conceit of using, you know, contemporary rap, R&B, minorities playing old white guys that are on our dollar bills. That's not, because to me, like, that conceit is like 80% of why this is a thing.
I think that's the reason it got popular. Like, people hear that and they're like, "Oh, that's interesting. I'll check it out."
Yeah, I think if you made the same exact musical with white people, but for lack of better words, in all the parts, because the real people were white people for the most part, not even for the most part, for all the part, I think this would still be an incredible musical. I think that's like a cherry on top that adds an extra layer thematically and narratively that just makes it a lot more interesting and like adds a lot of more emotion to it when you think about the reality of the way life was back then, especially for people of color, and the way it's life still is for many people of color. But I think that's not what makes this musical what it is.
Fair enough. Fair enough. To my mind, Phantom of the Opera or Les Mis, you know, have a few songs which go beyond anything that Hamilton touches. And maybe I'm just sort of a sucker a bit for, I guess, that more classical musical type song. Again, I think some of the songs in Hamilton are fantastic because I think in general songs in great musicals are great. You know, I don't see people gushing over the songs of Phantom of the Opera and Les Mis. Because like, whatever, those didn't become pop cultural icons the way that Hamilton has, which is fair, you know, again.
And I think that's just because that the music of Hamilton more closely resembles what is popular music today Les Mis like wasn't, the music of Les Mis wasn't really reflecting popular music at the time.
Yeah, that's fair. Aaron, are you, yes. Hamilton is your top five favorite movies of 2020, or you're not going to go that far?
I mean, I'm the one person, I have not watched this.
Wow.
So
the movies we've all seen, the only two, it seems, are First Cow and Archive.
Yeah. I'm in Washington, D.C. I don't know if that's why. I don't know what it is. I haven't gotten around to watching it. I'm a musical fan. I like a lot of musicals, so it's not my aversion to the medium in any shape or form. I'll watch it at some point. Sometimes hype does the opposite to me.
So am I to understand that there is an episode of the Movie Ladder that you have not listened to?
Yeah. I had to avoid that one. Usually I do listen to them, but I figured that one, I really don't want to, I tried to just kind of tune out what you guys were talking about because I do want to experience this one day and then tell everybody about it like no one knows about it. I love doing that. That's like my favorite thing to do. Like, so 6 months from now, be ready for me to like blow up the WhatsApp and be like, "Hey, this Hamilton musical is something else."
Will, give us your final thumbs up or thumbs down for Hamilton, since I think you brought it up.
Big thumbs up. It would be in my top five things I've watched that are like new this year.
Nice.
I'm not going to say movies, but it's in my top five.
Okay, so you're lukewarm your lukewarm July wasn't so fantastic for movies seems to have spun around a bit. You know, we got Hamilton, we got Archive, which, you know, seemed to be of interest to you. Palm Springs, of course, we'll discuss in a bit. Will First Cows is something you'd recommend? You didn't really speak about it much.
To the average film goer, I would not recommend it. I think if you know what you're getting into, I would recommend it because it's a very specific type of movie. It's very deliberate. But
you were not inspired, Will, to go check out other Riker movies.
I'm curious, I'll say. Yeah.
Okay. So you and Aaron,
I would watch Wendy and Lucy, and if you don't like that, then I would just say you're probably just not going to like this filmmaker.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, it might just be my personal taste, you know.
A movie that I think just came out this past weekend called Yes, God, Yes. And it's about a young girl named Alice who is Catholic, I think. Yeah, and she's in this some sort of, you know, Christian camp or school. And the crux of the movie is, you know, in this camp that she's in, they're very much stressing, you know, the merits and importance of celibacy and avoiding any sorts of impure thoughts in order to kind of, you know, fulfill your religious destiny. And Alice, of course, is a normal teenager with hormones and inclinations and everything that goes along with that. And having grown up religious as an Orthodox Jewish person, I related a lot to this movie in terms of just the lecture she gets from her teacher or counselors, whoever these people are, just reminded me a lot of the speeches of my youth of being warned against illicit thoughts and interacting with the opposite gender. And
I thought you were going to say the speeches you give to your own daughters.
Yeah. And it's just like, it's, you know, being a teenager and like going through puberty and like developing hormones and all the awkwardness of like sexual awakening is like enough on its own. And then when like you like add onto that a layer of like the extra like guilt and awkwardness that comes from religious leaders telling you all the time that like what you're feeling either isn't normal or this isn't how you're supposed to be feeling, or this is, you know, you have to kind of suppress those thoughts in order to live a proper life. It was just, you know, there's a lot about this that felt really, really familiar to me.
Yeah, yeah, no, I definitely agree. It's a strong recommendation for me as well. First off, I think it's a great tie-in to a movie we're going to discuss a little bit later on the episode, our feature, Palm Spring, because both the lead here and the lead there have very, very large expressive eyes. And I think that is part of their acting chops and acting charm. And a big part of both the success of Palm Springs and the success of Yes, God, Yes is how charming and delightful the lead is. I think without such a charming lead in Yes, God, Yes, the movie doesn't work. And I think she acts very well. Like, there's a lot of pensiveness. There's a lot of, like, anxiety, confidence. You know, like, she goes on a journey over the course of the movie. So I think she does a really, really great job. The movie, we should say, it was based on a short, I think, that came out a year and a half ago, which is also in the Ether. You can find it online streaming. And the short is a little bit different. It's like the first 20 minutes of the movie. Or condensed to, I guess, 5 minutes. So it's also kind of fun to see how one became the other. To me, I guess the limiting factor of Yes, God, Yes is at a certain point, the story does become another teen drama. So it's good. It's not a great movie for me because...
Yeah, I agree with that. But yeah, I think it's definitely worth watching. I don't think it's great. I don't think this is going to be like on any like top lists at the end of the year. But it's just like, it's a nice little short film with, as you said, a great performance from the lead. I was not familiar with her before this.
Yeah, I'm not known for my PC takes, but certainly 2020, if I was just to sort of without any preparation reflect on it, there's been a lot of very strong female-led movies. And I don't think I'm selecting them. I'm not like looking out for them per se. But from, you know, Always, Sometimes, Maybe, from The Assistant, Yes, God, Yes, pretty much every movie but First Cow, I think it's like strongly female-led movie, but you know, we'll touch on the cow.
I think it just also does a really good job of portraying the counselor characters, one of which is played by the guy who plays Jonah in Veep.
Yeah.
As like, you know, they're kind of these like authoritarian like leaders who not like just who are in charge of everything and very strict, but it has a certain empathy for them and like exposes their hypocrisy, I think, without in a non-judgmental way, because like, you know, basically saying like, you know, what they're expecting of themselves and of other people is basically impossible.
Yeah.
And, you know, that doesn't make them necessarily bad people. They just kind of bought into this belief system that requires an impossible leap of them.
Anything else off? Any other movies you strongly recommend or dislike?
Yeah, I mean, I also saw another movie. It's on Netflix. It's called The Old Guard. I wouldn't necessarily give it a strong recommend. Although if you're willing to just watch what I thought was a very fun action movie with great action scenes and Charlize Theron being an awesome badass goddess, literally and figuratively, I thought it was a good time. It was
How would you compare this to Extraction in terms of a recommendation?
I liked it better than Extraction. I thought there was a little more there. It was kind of just like an interesting take on like the superhero genre in general, insofar as the movie is about a group of like immortal warriors, for lack of a better term, who have been, I guess, fighting the world's battles and right and wrongs for thousands of years, because they don't have the ability to die. But they don't have any other superhero powers. Like, they're just regular people who, you know, fight using conventional weaponry other than...
I would say dumb regular people.
Yeah, like, they're right. There's nothing special about them other than the fact that they can't die. Which I just thought was fun to kind of see superheroes who don't really have powers fighting against other people. So,
yeah.
And the action sequences are just, like, really, really well choreographed. A lot of scenes that kind of just, like, really made me, like, move to the edge of my seat and less, like... watch closer as they went. So it was, I think it's worth watching if that's your jam, but it's definitely not a must watch.
So I would recommend against the movie, except for Charlize Theron. She's incredible and she's just so good. You know, she's so good at that Mad Max type female act. I would say, you know, she might be the best action gender aside star we have today. You know, I guess maybe her and Keanu Reeves, but I find her more kind of has a cooler edge than him. Something about him, it doesn't work for me as well. So she's so good, and therefore for that alone. But otherwise, let me give you a few things I thought don't work in the movie. The bad guy is like so bad, it's like dumb that he's bad. It's almost good how silly and like undeveloped and just bad a character he is. I mean, like, he wears Italian custom suits with a stitched-in hoodie, just to kind of give you a sense of like how silly his character is. Secondly, the lead of the movie isn't Charlize. The lead of the movie, I think her name is Kiki Lane. I just feel she has no screen presence. I also felt in Beale Street Could Talk, she didn't have much screen presence. She just doesn't like command a screen like you see new faces in action movies, as you said, in superhero movies do. And therefore, when the lead isn't really doing much, the movie isn't really doing much. I'll give you another pet peeve, Alvin. Like, feel free to jump in here and like deflect or agree with me. Every single time the movie wants to explain the mythology of the universe to Kiki's new girl character, instead, she's told, you should just get some sleep. At no point do they ever explain the mythology of how this works. And I guess they're sort of setting it up for, obviously, sequels or whatnot, and I imagine there will be a sequel. But come on, I mean, like, I don't know, what happens, like, when their heads are cut off? Or, like, how do the characters have ear piercings? I don't know, I mean, that's a dumb thing. But you know what I'm saying? Like, there's just so much kind of interest there. And I'm not saying they had to have some long, exposition. But I think they skimp on that a bit too much. Let me throw a few more things to you. These people have been alive for millennium in some cases, and their secret hideout is not a $1 trillion fortune, you know, that they've squirreled away by, I don't know, inserting $1 in like the tulip market in the 1600s or something. Their hideaway is an empty mine shaft where they sleep on rocks surrounded by like, you know, dusty antiques. I just felt that was a little silly. Like, you know, you think they would use a little bit more chachma, bina, and dat, as the sages say, in order, again, to help them do good things in the world. I mean, ultimately, I'm like, what is... The kind of takeaway is that their superpower is that over the years, they've repeatedly saved people who like two generations later or a generation later ended up becoming important, which I guess because the idea is they've lived through history. So therefore they understand historical trends. So they kind of understood that that guy would become Martin Luther King. So therefore we should save him when he's a small child. But like, I don't know, that isn't really explained much. I'll leave it on maybe two quick things. One is that it has that comic book kind of silliness. There's that scene where Charlize hops off a train in the middle of Africa, in the middle of the desert, and it's a narrative way of saying that the characters are splitting up. But if you don't have any superpowers to jump off a train in the middle of the desert when you have to go to the other side of the world, I don't know, it just doesn't make sense, particularly when she gets to the other side of the world within 24 hours. Again, I guess that just doesn't matter because, as you said, it's a comic book, it's a superhero movie, and we just don't care about that. Finally, something which I kind of is a driving narrative in the movie throughout, this is kind of the driving plot of the movie, is how her peers turn on her instantly when Kiki Lane becomes this sort of, you know, superhero type character, and how her brothers and sisters in the Marines instantly turn on her and want to have nothing to do with her. And I don't know, I've, like, again, I served in the military. I have a good group of friends, not connected to the military here where I live. And I would like to think that if something like that or something also transcendental happened to me, my loved ones, my, you know, close brothers and sisters wouldn't, like, immediately turn on me and, like, want nothing to do with me. I could be completely wrong, but that's, like, the movie wants us to accept that as, like, the driving obstacle. And it just completely never worked for me. Maybe it wasn't an issue for you.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think too many of those criticisms are unfair. I don't think it was, you know, a brilliant movie. I would agree that a lot of the world building, what, you know, was kind of done a little bit lazily with a lot of hand waving. But yeah, I mean, I as I said, like, you know, it's not a great movie. I think it's a, you know, it's a fun movie that has some fun scenes in it. And I think Charlize Theron is great as always. And I really enjoyed seeing her get this sort of role. But you know, if you're looking for more than that, I don't think that's what you're going to get here.
Yeah. Did you appreciate the fact that our number one basketball movie of all time was directed by the same director of this movie?
Oh, I didn't even realize that.
Yeah. So there was a whole bit about how the fact that this was directed by not only a female director, but a female director of color. And it just was like, oh, I saw Love and Basketball, you know, which was a movie. I like Love and Basketball a lot, but if we wouldn't have done our sports odyssey, I probably would not have seen that movie. So it was kind of cool to having seen Love and Basketball. You can somewhat, she got this movie because of Love and Basketball. That's what, you know, has been said in interviews. So yeah, so that's a nice kind of a little shout out there. Av, can I give you a few movies I liked or disliked?
Sure.
So one that I liked, but it would be probably toward the bottom of my recommendations, is a movie called Mr. Jones. Mr. Jones, it's based on a true story. It's sort of like your dad movie of the month. And I guess
it's based on the Counting Crows song.
It could be based on many things, actually, with the name Mr. Jones. No, so the dad movie of the month is a movie I think Av, you and I both skipped. It's a Tom Hanks World War II movie where he's like a Navy captain. But this is the other dad movie of the month. Mr. Jones is the true story of a guy named Gareth Jones, aka the name of my nephew, who in the 1940, like right at the beginning of World War II, he was a 25, 26-year-old sort of journalist, political advisor. And he decided that he was going to go to Moscow to interview Stalin because he wanted to sort of figure out what was the situation in the Soviet Union. And he gets there convinced that the Soviets are going to give him an interview with Stalin. Obviously, again, this is all a true story. Obviously, he gets there and no one is interested in giving him an interview with Joseph Stalin. So instead, he sort of wheedles his way down into the Ukraine. Journalists at the time were not allowed outside of Moscow because the Soviets were, you know, torturing their country. There's a famous famine that took place in that time period, which is the way that the Soviet Union was able to industrialize in the late 30s and 40s, and they industrialized at an incredible rate, is that they starved their Ukrainian population. So Stalin systematically starved, I think it's like 4 million people. You know, he killed over 40 million people. He was a horrible, horrible dictator. But in this particular atrocity, he effectively centralized farming in the Ukraine, took all the grain and didn't leave any of it behind in the winter, so the people starved. And then he took all the grain and sold it overseas so he could industrialize, you know, and build tanks and whatnot. So the reason we know about that famine is because of this 26-year-old journalist, Gareth Jones. He was incredibly heroic. He effectively got on a train through some sort of fake documents claiming that he was working for the foreign minister of England. And while he was on the train, he gave his minder the slip, jumped onto a different train, and wandered off for 3 days into the Ukraine. After 3 days, the police arrested him, they tortured him, and then they eventually let him go on condition that he couldn't tell the story of what happened. And if he did tell the story, they were going to assassinate 10 British, like, industrial advisors who were in Moscow in you know, the Soviets had captured. Suffice to say, he did go back, did release the story, and then, again, this is completely a true story, so sharing some of this plot isn't really ruining it. And the sort of the conflict, which is, if you know anything about this topic, which I guess most people don't, is well known, is there's a famous journalist who was the New York Times correspondent in Moscow throughout World War II, and he was an apologist for Stalin. He basically kowtowed to the party line, and he came out against this reporter, Gareth Jones. So Jones was publishing stuff saying Stalin is murdering millions of people. And this New York Times reporter came out with stuff saying, no, it's complete baloney. Stalin is a hero. The Soviet Union is our friend against Hitler. And because of, as you can guess, political expediencies, poor Mr. Jones was not really believed very much. And he went back to sort of, I think, Central Asia somewhere to be a reporter, and the Soviet secret police assassinated him. So he was killed when he was 27 years old as a reporter who, you know, wanted to stand up for the truth and not just sort of give the party lying. So the director is a famous Polish female director. She's made a lot of movies about, she made a movie called Europa Europa, which is, I think, very well known. And she has said very intentionally she wanted to make a movie that spoke to the present day in terms of the pursuit of truth that journalists should aspire to, as opposed to, you know, the example of the reporters. A lot of the movie is kind of the conflict between the reporters in Moscow. What I would say about the movie as a movie is that it's good, but it's not great. You know, it's not as great as Yes, God, Yes, meaning it's not as good as Yes, God, Yes, and neither of them is great. The problem with Mr. Jones is there are certain scenes which are very powerful. The last third of the movie feels like it was supposed to be triple the length. And apparently when the movie was released at a film festival earlier this year before COVID, or last year, it was double the length and they severely cut something down. So the movie doesn't work. Like the last third, you're confused and you have to go to Wikipedia afterwards and read what's going on. But if you're interested in historical dramas, if anything about sort of the Soviet Union and pre-World War II interests you, the lead in it is pretty good. You know, it's a good historical drama. And I think, you know, for giving what we're getting these days, that can sort of be enough. So that's a good but not great recommendation, Mr. Jones. Have I convinced you, or are you going to leave that for the Alex Chesters of the world? The
people. Yeah, I think I'll skip on that one.
Yeah, that's a movie you can skip if you're not into that genre, I would say, certainly. I'll give one last kind of even more, you know, yes and no, as they say in Chinese, mama huhu. That means like a little bit yes, a little bit no recommendation. And that it's a movie called Tommaso. Now, Tommaso, it's an Italian word. It's the name of the character. I might be butchering the pronunciation, but it's Italian. It's an unusual movie. What is it? Have you seen Bad Lieutenant, either the original in the 90s or the remake with Nicolas Cage?
No, I have not.
Okay, so Bad Lieutenant, I highly recommend, unless you're in a bad mood or you're depressed or you just don't want to be shocked. I tend to like the original more than the Nicolas Cage remake with Werner Herzog, who made it, but they're both actually pretty good movies. The original is made by a New York City Italian-American director who the best way to say is he's like the drug-addled Scorsese. His name is Abel Ferrara. Ferrara is exactly the same age as Scorsese. He has a similar kind of career arc. His movies were made, I guess, a little bit later in the 80s and the 90s, and his movies are all about violent people in New York City. Most of his movies were set into New York City, very violent, lots of drugs, a lot of Catholic guilt. Again, it doesn't have the artistry of Martin Scorsese by any means, but there's definitely, I can see the two of them are kind of working in simpatio. So what is this movie? This is directed by Abel Ferrara. Willem Dafoe, who is his next door neighbor in Rome and apparently his best friend and has been in his like last four movies. Willem Dafoe stars in the movie as a director who is living in what is actually, the movie is filmed in Abel Ferrara's apartment, and Willem Dafoe is playing a director who lives in that apartment. Willem Dafoe's wife and daughter in the movie are Abel Ferrara's actual wife and actual daughter. And in the movie, Willem Dafoe is making Abel Ferrara's next movie. That's a movie called Siberia, starring Willem Dafoe, which is coming out in a few months. So, you know, you can kind of see where, you know, this movie is going. Effectively, the movie is like it's the director giving a meta narrative about his own life. And what that life is it's some old Italian-American director living in Rome with a much younger, hot model wife coming to terms with like the drugs and the alcohol and the violence he had as a younger man and sort of the yoga and the sort of, you know, finding a truth which he's aspiring to as an older man. And that's what the movie is. Suffice to say, Dafoe is incredible in the movie. The main reason to see this movie is for Dafoe. If you like Willem Dafoe, particularly maybe after, you know, the movie I know Will liked a lot last year, then you should see Tommaso. Or I guess if you love Abel Ferrara, but that's probably a smaller crowd. That said, the movie isn't great. It's very drawn out. It drags at time. It's a little bit, it has a lot of indie kind of cliches. But have you seen like Dafoe's Last Temptation of Christ? Talk about a Scorsese movie.
Yeah, I did see that. I saw that last year. I did my Scorsese
like,
watch.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah. So there's like four scenes in this movie, which are direct references to that. There's a lot of scenes which are like references to Dafoe movies. Obviously a ton of references to Bad Lieutenant and other kind of Ferrara movies. So that if you're a fan of either of those two characters, this movie kind of engages in a very fun way with both of those, particularly I would say Last Temptation of Christ. It's an interesting, compelling movie, particularly if you're like a film fan, I would recommend it. but it's not a general audience movie. So it was, to me, I put it at the very top of my I don't recommend list, because I can't recommend it for most audiences. I don't know if I convinced you, Alv, or not.
I'll look into it.
Okay, let me give you, just in these last few minutes, a few, I'll just do bam, bam, bam. These movies I all don't recommend. Mucho Mucho Amor, it's another movie that's way too dragged out. It's a documentary about an incredibly famous Latin astrologer named Walter Mercado. He's basically the alter ego of Trump, same ego, same hairstyle, except he was a really nice guy. And Lin-Manuel Miranda has a major role in this movie. I would say the documentary is sort of like the Dr. Ruth documentary last year, except much more dragged out. So if you really love that, you'll like this. If you like a movie about a guy who's 10 times as weird as Dr. Ruth. To me, too much, just watch the trailer. Three classic indies that went straight to screaming and you should skip: Clementine, Last Tree, Short History of the Long Road. Nothing worth saying about them, skip them. And finally, there is a famous Korean director. People maybe are checking out Korean movies after Parasite. So I guess two of his movies came out this past month. The movies were made 3 years apart, but they decided to release both of them this July. The director's name is Hong Sang-soo. He's, again, one of the most kind of celebrated directors in Korea. He's known for making a movie every 6 months, and his movies are all unscripted domestic relationship stories. The two that came out in July are called Yourself and Yours and Hill of Freedom. If you look on Rotten Tomatoes, they both have like 90s reviews, but again, a lot of, I guess, indie foreign releases tend to get those. I didn't like either one of them. They're very similar. They're both kind of, the script is a little flat, the camera is ugly, the narrative doesn't do much. I would say check out Hill of Freedom, which is a little more fun. Check out Hill of Freedom, and if you want to kind of get a sense of the director, definitely skip Yourself and Yours. Let's talk feature.
Good day so far?
Today, tomorrow, it's all the same.
You, what is going on? Hey, get out of the water!
Guess you followed me. It's one of those infinite time loop situations you might have heard about.
That I might have heard about?
Yeah.
The second you fall asleep, it all just goes back to the start.
I drove all the way back home to Austin, and I still woke up here.
One time I smoked a bunch of crystal and made it all the way to Equatorial Guinea. It was a huge waste of time.
Well, then what's the point of living?
We kind of have no choice but to live.
No, I'm gonna get out of this.
Suit yourself.
See you tomorrow.
Av, can you tell us what is Palm Springs effectively about? And I believe it is not, it has nothing really to do with the location, the small town in California.
Yeah, I mean, well, the small town in California plays a role, obviously, but basically it's a romantic comedy with a time loop twist. It stars Andy Samberg and Christian Milioti, who meet at a wedding in Palm Springs, and we soon learn that Andy Samberg's character, Niles, has been in a time loop for a period of time, and Christian Milioti's character quickly finds herself in the same time loop, and they kind of explore the time loop together. And in the process, a romance emerges between the two of them.
We'll get into this in a bit, but my addendum to Av's commentary would be, and then every single trope in a rom-com movie takes place. But maybe you guys will defend and push back against that in a moment. Before we go there, though, let me introduce our special guest that we have joining us to discuss this feature. I'll give some of his credentials. A leading theoretical physicist, he's published dozens of papers about black holes and quantum gravity, and he served as the science advisor to dozens of movies, including MCU standouts like Av's Avengers Endgames. And of course, he also was the advisor to this movie, Palm Springs. Of course, I'm speaking about USC Professor Clifford Johnson. Now, we did not get Professor Clifford Johnson, so we did the next best thing, and we got another theoretical physicist, my brother Shai Chester, to join us instead. Now, Dr. Johnson and Dr. Chester not only share the same field, but this past week, Dr. Chester, aka my brother, was forced to give a lecture on Dr. Johnson's academic writings, given that the USC professor was too busy promoting the recently released Andy Samberg film. Let's set aside a few minutes. Shai's gonna join us and discuss the movie as a whole, but let's start off with a bit of science. I prepared a few questions to ask Shai, again, our Dr. Chester, our theoretical physicist, but Av and Will, please join me as well. I'm sure you prepared your own complex questions about the quantum gravity behind this movie.
This is basically like the scene in the movie where Sarah goes and learns physics. So we're just, you know, moving that to the front.
Yeah, yeah. It's a montage of her learning theoretical physics in, you know, conceivably years. You know, it could take as long as you want. We didn't mention this, but Clifford Johnson, when I gave those credentials, I wasn't making this up. He is a famous science advisor in Hollywood. He did advise on Endgame and many other movies. And he not only advised on Palm Springs, but he is in the movie. You see Sarah speaking to him on Skype or Zoom, presumably, probably Zoom, about physics. So with that said, Shai, Dr. Chester, what, if any, science would you say is really at work in this movie, Palm Spring? I think there is a popular theory you can find on Reddit streams called the Cauchy theory. How accurate is the science in this movie?
Okay, so there's no such thing as a Cauchy theory. People are probably talking about something called the Cauchy horizon. And so I think what they're just referring to is the fact that there's certain kinds of black holes where first, when you approach the black hole, you would go past something called the event horizon, which is just the point for which you can't return. So once you go past that, you can't go back. But when you cross this event horizon, you wouldn't experience anything unusual. In fact, you wouldn't even know that you've crossed it. And we expect event horizons to exist. In fact, there's many black holes we observe, and they certainly have event horizons. Cauchy horizon is something different, though. Cauchy horizon is more of a mathematical thing, and it's saying that there's like a certain point in specific, probably mathematical black holes, maybe not realistic ones, where if you would go past this point, basically the equations would break down and things would stop making sense.
I think you lost most of the audience when you said mathematical black holes versus real black holes.
So I guess I'm just saying that, like, it's very, very, very unlikely that a Cauchy horizon would actually exist in nature. It's kind of like in the Middle Ages when people were exploring the world and they would put like dragons on the map and they would say, here be dragons. And it's not necessarily like they actually thought they were dragons. They were just saying they had no idea what was there. And so they just drew a dragon. And so similarly, something like a Cauchy horizon, it's like almost certainly impossible that it could actually exist because it would mean that equations wouldn't make sense. So it's basically a way of saying that the equations break down at this point. And so, like, I guess, you know, for science fiction people, you can use that as a way to kind of like put in magic, basically, because you could say like, oh, a Cauchy horizon happened, and we have no idea what happens when that happens, and so thus anything can happen. Just with the principle that a contradiction implies anything.
Pivoting to a different perspective, would you say, let's use Will as an example. If Will was for some reason stuck in his home for an endless period of time and all he did was from scratch start studying theoretical physics, at what point do you think he could surpass you and Dr. Clifford Johnson in his knowledge of black holes? Because that's effectively what takes place in the movie, right? They take someone who presumably knows absolutely nothing about science and they give her enough kind of intro books and connection to the internet. And at some point in time, she becomes a genius.
Gerardus Tuft, who on his website, he actually has a list of every single thing you would have to learn to go from knowing absolutely nothing to being an expert at quantum gravity. And for every single thing on that list, he gives references to like YouTube videos and books you could read. So in principle, you could follow that. Although like one would have to be aware that like once you become an expert at this, that just means you're as much of an expert as anybody else's. And none of the experts have figured out this stuff. So you would have to really not only become an expert, but become better than every expert, which might be impossible.
But the power of love. This is a rom-com after all. Will, do you guys have any science questions for Shai, Palm Springs or otherwise? I was interested in kind of getting his take about what does he make of physics in the movies in general?
I'd be curious, like, if is there any other movie that, like, you think really nails the science on this sort of stuff?
So the classic example is Interstellar. And I think it's funny because, like, a lot of people who aren't scientists who watch Interstellar are like, oh, wow, you know, the science of the movie is so ridiculous. Like, if only movies were more realistic. Whereas, like, I saw the movie with a bunch of my buddies when I was at Princeton, who were all theoretical physicists.
Humble brag, Princeton.
And we all loved it because we all thought it was super scientifically accurate. And it was actually rare that you see a movie which actually portrays the kind of, like, weird stuff we study in a realistic way. Like, so much so that they even hired a very prominent theoretical physicist, whose name I can't remember, but he won the Nobel Prize 2 years ago. And he, like, did numerical simulations to simulate the black holes in that movie, and he actually wrote some papers based on it. So, like, not only was the science real, but in fact, like, new research was done based on that movie. Of course, there's also some, like, stuff they put in, with, like, the love thing at the end. Like, I mean, obviously that is poetic license. But, like, most of the stuff is, like, either, like, real science or speculative science, of which there's a good chance that it would be accurate. But it's just ironic that, like, so many people I would talk to, in fact, disliked the movie because they thought it was so unreal.
I think it's funny because people, tell me if this is true. I think I once saw statistics that audiences like when movies begin with the quote based on a true story. That line at the beginning of a movie is said to sort of, you know, it drives audience engagement in the film that then follows. And I wonder whether audiences like to know whether there's real science in a movie. And the example I would give would be The Martian, I think the appeal of The Martian, and Shai, I'd be interested in your take. I know you're not an agronomist per se, but The Martian presents itself as everything is, so to speak, scientifically realistic, from the way he grows potatoes, to the way he drives, to the way they do that sort of slingshot to save him at the end, spoiler. You know, would you, first off, is The Martian, would you say, falls within the realm from your understanding of scientifically accurate? And would you agree that, do you think audiences, I mean, this isn't really a question for Shai, I guess it's for, you know, Often Will as well. Do audiences want real science in their movies?
So a movie like The Martian, to me, it's like not scientifically so interesting because it's just kind of engineering. Like, I mean, the question of like whether or not you can grow plants on Mars is something you could have answered 100 years ago. You know, like similarly, the idea of like the slingshot is just basic mechanics, which is also understood 200 years ago.
You have to understand physicists dislike engineers because everything they do is practical and physicists prefer things that are impractical and theoretical.
No, I mean, it's not a matter of practical versus impractical. It's just like if the ideas are like sufficiently deep. Like the ideas in The Martian are not so different from what it would be like to grow plants on Earth. It's just a slightly different atmosphere. Like, I mean, if you're growing plants on a black hole or something, you know, like maybe that would require like actually new ideas. But like, you know, it's not so shocking to see someone growing plants on a slightly different atmosphere than Earth. For me, at least.
How about like 2001: A Space Odyssey? Science? No science.
Well, I mean, for me personally, I prefer philosophical science fiction to what's called hard science fiction. So hard science fiction is where like they try to do as realistic science as possible. I think that's okay. But to me, it's a lot more interesting if you're able to like express, I don't know, interesting philosophical ideas using science fiction. And I don't really care so much, you know, if it's like accurate than a hard way.
Yeah, one of the movies that came out, I think we'll discuss a bit later or earlier because, you know, Palm Springs is affecting this podcast, Archive, I think maybe touches on some of what Shai's referring to. Shai, maybe give us one just before we leave the science behind. What movie would you say besides Interstellar? What are one or two movies that really stand out in how they depict physics that you would recommend to people? Maybe they haven't heard about
it. Other than Interstellar, I mean, I can recommend movies that involve time travel. Like there was this kind of like indie movie, I forget it's called like Pulsar or Primer.
Primer, yeah.
So that's a really good movie. Mostly just because it's so confusing that like, I guess it kind of accurately represents how confused you would be if you were time traveling, because it would be bizarre. You would keep like running into paradoxes all the time. So like, I don't think it's trying to be scientifically accurate, but like it's maybe psychologically accurate in that it would portray how confused and shocked and weird it would be if you could actually travel through time. In terms of movies that like do science in a particularly accurate way, other than Interstellar, I mean, like what was that classic movie from the 90s based on the Carl Sagan book, Contact? I mean, like, that has a bit of that, like, corny 90s feel to it, but, like, at least the book is, like, a fun book, and, like, it does kind of explore a lot of ideas that aren't, like, totally far-fetched, like, you know, the idea of, like, using wormholes to travel throughout the universe, because it would be impossible to do it otherwise, because, like, a spaceship would take forever, and, like, it explores ideas of, like, you know, like, how would you communicate to another alien civilization, which might not even have the concept of language, like, what's some kind of, like, constant, which they would eventually understand, you know, some kind of mathematical pattern. So like, I forget how much of that was in the movie. I think they actually do include a fair amount of it in the movie based on the book. So I think it's like another, I mean, I'm sure that inspired Interstellar. There's someone analogous and stuff.
Any other science questions or should we jump into the non-science of Palm Springs?
Let's get into the movie.
Okay, great. So Shai, while we drew him in for his physics knowledge, also did see the movie. So Shai, you're welcome to join us and share your insights. Maybe just because I think Shai may wander off, give us your two-sentence take on the movie, science aside.
I mean, it's obviously just a copy of Groundhog Day with Andy Samberg. I thought it was entertaining. I didn't really think it did that much that Groundhog Day didn't do, but like, I was entertained. And like, I think it's like appealing during coronavirus because everyone's feeling like we're living the same day again and again. And that is the Groundhog Day theme, so it makes sense to have a movie like that.
A rousing endorsement from our in-house theoretical physicist. I would like to maybe turn in that direction. I think Shai said at the end, the word living in your house. And that is, I think, very fitting for two reasons. One, because the bubble hopelessness, correct me if I'm wrong, Alvin, Will, is, you know, it's the reason, I think, why this is the deserving feature of the month. But much more so, one of us on this pod right now is celebrating a tremendous achievement related to an in-house experience. Am I right?
Are you talking about me buying a house?
Yes, Will bought a house. That's such an Andy Samberg thing to do, to like buy a house. You should write a song about buying a house, Will.
That'd be a good idea.
Yeah. It's like,
I don't know how it would go.
Use the theme from like, I'm on a boat, or like, I just had sex. Like, I just bought a house.
I mean, I don't want to, yeah, I feel like it would come off as very braggadocious though.
Yeah, but look, Sandberg made a whole song that was braggadocious, and look what he did for his career. Anyways, what do you guys think about Palm Springs, starting maybe with the bubbleness of it, the COVID-ness of it, and going on from there?
Yeah, I mean, just starting off with that, I think this was released at a very fortunate time. I'm sure they didn't plan it this way. but yeah, it might help that I haven't seen Groundhog Day in a very long time. But I really loved this movie. It's like the first movie in a while that's like a new movie I've seen during all this COVID quarantine times that I've been able to really connect with. I feel like recently I've been just going back to old movies I've already seen and enjoyed. And anything that's like, you know, I would normally be watching lots of like new and depressing, dark
bad movies.
Yeah. Well, depressingly bad or just depressing art house movies. But you know, I've been going much more in a different direction lately, and I think that might shape why I connected so much with Palm Springs. But I think there's a lot to love about it that is not just tied to the situation we're in right now.
Av, how about you?
Yeah, I mean, I'll echo that. I found both of the leads here to be positively charming. I thought they had exceptional chemistry together. They were very believable as both a couple and as like sort of frenemies who kind of, you know, going up against each other. There's a few scenes in this movie, just like montages almost, of like there's one of Andy Samberg having sex with everybody at the party, and then another one of them, the two of them, and Niles and Sarah kind of like doing shtick together at the various places, doing explosions, getting these like dance numbers, just really just like having fun together. So like you actually do get to see their relationship blossom, and it's like believable that they've fallen in love by halfway through the movie. And what I think the movie does really well is you think you're starting at the beginning of Groundhog Day, but in a way you're starting at the end of it, almost for Andy Samberg's character. And what you realize, I guess, like for me, like halfway through the movie, is that this isn't actually Niles' movie, it's Sarah's movie, and that she kind of comes in at the point together with the viewer, and we learn about the world and how it works through her and her exploration and experimenting with it. And he's the one that's already just like given up hope and like content with the situation. I don't think it's a coincidence that his name is Niles, because he has a very nihilist attitude towards the situation. Whereas she's the one that still thinks there's like an opportunity to get out. But, you know, obviously he's gone through all the motions. He's done all this 100 times already, and he knows there's no hope. And I just thought that interplay between the two of them was really interesting. And just the two of them together are very charming on screen. And I'll echo Will, I absolutely love this movie.
So I think they're very charming. That's what I'd written down, like in big letters. And I think they're fun to hang out with. And the pacing of the movie's pretty quick. And the movie's always moving. It doesn't really, except for like one drawn out scene in the desert with dinosaurs, and then, you know, that ends with sex. The movie really is moving the entire way. You know, particularly because they're constantly waking up and doing the day over again. So the pacing is bam, bam, bam. I do think though, and Samberg's kind of actually said this, I think he's a very self-effacing guy, which I appreciate. But I think both of them, certainly Samberg, have a very limited acting range. I think Sandberg's smile is limitless. Like his lips and teeth seem like they can stretch for miles. I think his range as an actor is the opposite. And I think he can be charming and fun to hang out with, but anything kind of beyond that, and the movie doesn't ask them. The movie doesn't ask them to do much more. You know, she might have more. We don't really know her as well as an actor. I certainly don't. But neither one of them I felt was pushed very far. It was a very safe rom-com with the trappings of a fun, you know, Groundhog Day type setup. And so I think for what they were asked to do, the leads worked excellently. But I could always sort of tell that there was a certain, you know, there was a certain talk about being in a bubble. The actors weren't being asked to sort of really stretch their limbs and really kind of go past a certain space. And therefore, you know, I felt that at least. In terms of the bubbleness, I mean, to me, this is the saving grace, and this is sort of why the movie is compelling. And I'm kind of curious about you guys. I don't know how much we want to get into this. I've had friends that use this COVID period, the last 5 months, to get super into new hobbies. They've gotten really into exercise, really into, you know, wine, really into movies. And I've been the opposite. I found it hard to be motivated. My running has dragged. My reading has dragged. As we've kind of discussed in previous episodes, our movie watching has all regressed in different ways. And I found Sandberg, particularly early on in the movie, his, some of his philosophical musings, some of the script touched on that really nicely. And I don't know, Av, if you can find any of those clips, if they're kind of banging around the internet. But there were a few lines, again, from Sandberg, the nihilism of him, that touched me and I particularly liked. But again, balancing those were the lines that just seemed to be trope rom-com. Particularly the last third of the movie, or really the last half. By that point, it also made me look back at where the movie had come until now, and I realized, like, okay, this entire thing was meet cute, wedding montage, talking about love, talking about past relationships. First we fall in love, then we fall out of love, then we get back together, then the guy has to be inspired, then they have to, like, do the last run to the airport. You know, like, everything was there. And I'll say it, I find rom-coms the most droll and unengaging of genres. And therefore, yes, I saw this movie twice, the second time to watch it with Dr. Chester. But it's the very, very rare rom-com that's really going to, you know, be a movie that really gets me excited. And therefore, this is a movie I'd recommend, but it's not a movie I hope is on my top 10 at the end of the year.
See, I would say the romance aspect of this rom-com felt incidental. I feel like the major arcs of this movie are the arcs of Andy Samberg and Kristen Milioti's characters. She was very good in Black Mirror too, just a side note. But yeah, I think both of their arcs, both the where each of them started really complements where they ended up, because he was stuck in this really terrible relationship where he wasn't feeling valued. His girlfriend was cheating on him all the time.
Again, that's a rom-com trope.
I guess we assume. Yeah, I mean, it is, but it fits well with them being like stuck in this time loop, because it's like they were already kind of stuck in this, in these, you know,
stasis.
Yeah, exactly. And like, you know, she was just kind of an alcoholic and going nowhere. No one in her family really seemed to respect her. And she used this time in a time loop to get really, really good at physics. Yeah, I feel like the movie could have just ended with them not getting together, and it would have been just as, you know, just as complete of a character arc.
Everything was leading there. I would have liked that. I would have liked if it was more challenging and complex. But there's a safeness, there's a vanilla-ness to the sort of genre experience that the movie is always in lockstep with. And I felt that very strongly throughout. Quick shout out, one of the philosophical ramblings of Sandberg I really liked. I identify very strongly with Sandberg's philosophy about the chocolate wafer. I'll leave it at that. If the viewers have seen the movie, you know what I'm talking about. When he's saying, like, this is what is meaningful in life, not where the chocolate came from and not what happens to it in your belly, but that bite. That's basically, my philosophy is very similar. So, you know, this may be the movie I philosophically identify with the most. Will, you seem to be saying, like, this is one of your movies of the year so far.
By default, sure. I liked it a lot, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so we'll get into this a bit when we've touched already. At the beginning of this episode, we touched on recent watches, but to make it sound as if we're going to do that in the future in honor of Palm Springs, I felt this was the best month for movies, for new movies of the year so far. I mean, you know, we're going to talk about movies like First Cow, like Hamilton, Archive, I really liked a lot. Palm Springs is engaging. Those four movies, again, we're in a weird year, but I would say those four movies are movies that right now are probably all fighting to be in my top 10. Arguably one of those is my number one, but you know, we'll discuss that later. So
I did think April, where we had like Bad Education and Blow the Man Down and The Assistant, I think that was probably a stronger month for me. And Never Rarely, Sometimes Always.
Yeah, though I think Never Rarely was March. March.
That was March?
I believe so, yeah. I believe so. At this point, I mean, all of COVID, maybe we'll just call one month at the end of the day.
Yeah, I mean, time is just you know, we're all stuck in a time loop at this point.
Yeah. I want to ask one question. I don't know if either of you guys noticed this or thought about this, but the date that is used in the movie is, and I mentioned it a bunch of times, is November 9th, which yeah. I looked up and I saw somebody else mention that this was the day that Einstein received the Nobel Prize for Physics. But it was also the day in 2016 that was the morning where we all woke up and realized that Donald Trump was going to be the president.
Oh, and wow.
I can't help but think that that's a coincidence, because it kind of taps into kind of like what a lot of people who, I guess those of us who are not the biggest fan of this administration have kind of been feeling for the last few years, where like every day just kind of feels like you're in this like quasi purgatory state, and there's just like this repetition to it, and it just seems like it's never ending. Again, I there's no like direct allusion to the fact that this is what's going on, but I guess it could have just been 1 in 365 chance that it chose that day, but it just seemed too much to be a coincidence to me.
I give you that. I like that. I like both. You know, this certainly a fun physics chart. I read an interview with the lead actress, Christina, can't even get her first name now.
Kristen?
And yeah, and she says that originally they shot like a 15-minute scene where she extrapolates on physics and Einstein and whatnot. So I do think there was sort of a, they were kind of engaging the material. So I wouldn't be surprised. Certainly, I think the Einstein thing makes sense. And the other part makes sense as well, because when you think of that month, you do think of the electoral calendar. Particularly with, you know, the year coming to, you know, right now we're having elections pretty soon. Was this movie originally supposed to hit theaters maybe later in the year? I think it was drawn up for COVID to release during Corona. I'm not sure.
Not sure. There's also just something about like being at one of these wedding weekends, like especially if you're a single person, that I think it taps into just that, like that loneliness of just like being at one of these parties where like you're expected to put on a happy face, but like you just, you know, you're, I guess because of your own situation, you're just like, you don't want to be there.
So I'm it's embarrassingly, I'm forgetting her name, but Below the Man Down, if you guys remember, my favorite character in the movie, my favorite actress in the movie, that was an actress driven movie, was the old grandma, June Squibb, I believe. Is that her name, the actress, June Squibb? I believe so. Maybe one of our listeners or you guys can correct me. And she's of course also in this movie. I think she has a much bigger part in Below the Man Down, so she's much more relevant there. She has this sort of like weird kind of, and the movie is happy to play with that, like the dinosaurs and a few other scenes. They're happy to sort of play with what's real and what isn't, because the movie's not taking itself too seriously, which is, you know, obviously with Andy Samberg, you can't. She, you know, she has those two scenes, particularly the latter one where she goes up to Sarah toward the end and she says something like, you know, that was a great speech. You know, good luck on your journey as you leave us.
Yeah, she says, I suppose you'll be going soon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just took that to mean she's kind of like the wise old woman there. I saw speculation that she's also been stuck on a day or something.
No, she's in the time loop.
Yeah.
No. I strongly 100%. Disagree with that. I think she's just like a wise old grandma.
She's been to so many weddings. You're for sure supposed to think that she's somehow involved.
Every grandma has been to many, many weddings. That's all grandmas talk about and do at that age.
I agree that it's supposed to feel like it's something that a person could say, but I definitely took away from that there's something going on with Nana.
Yeah, so we don't have to get too much into the mechanics of you know, Av, I know you rewatched a few time loop movies in preparation for this podcast, perhaps, Back to the Future and whatnot.
Yes.
There was a bit where, you know, I like to think that Samberg has been repeating the day for, you know, centuries. Like, I like to think it's really been endless time. To me, that's part of the appeal. And he seems to sort of identify with that. And therefore, you know, without kind of getting into how these kind of time repetition type things work, we no longer have our theoretical physicist. He went off to the bathroom, I think. But if he's meeting her in just one of his endless loops, then, you know, this is just another multiverse or something. You know, this is just another one where, okay, in this one, she's spirited out of it, and now she's also caught in the loop. But in all the previous, I don't know, you know, like, I don't try to dwell on these things too much. To me, it's not necessary, particularly in a movie with this level of gravity.
I mean, I assume that every day that Andy Samberg lives, like, creates a new timeline.
So like he's kind of
from the results of that day.
He's kind of resetting the world, boom, boom, boom. It's like Superman spinning the world back or something.
Yeah.
One thing that was interesting, and I guess, you know, we don't want to get too much into the mechanics because, you know, I don't know how much they work, but she first does the experiment with a goat, and then she verifies that it works because the goat is no longer in the time loop. But
yeah, but like everyone else who's moving on from this day is still
there.
In
the very, very end, when J.K. Simmons' character, who we haven't even talked about, but there's a mid-credits scene where he comes to the wedding and sees Andy Samberg, and Andy Samberg is like, who the hell are you? I don't recognize you. And we're supposed to, I think, conclude from that whatever they did worked, they're out of the time loop, and he is still in it. But then, like, why does the goat leave the time loop, but Andy Samberg stays in the time loop when he's left the time loop?
Yeah, that doesn't quite add up. I think because a goat is just inconsequential to the plot, so
I guess, right. Yeah, fair enough.
But it doesn't really fit figure in so much. Yeah, I mean, you know, Simmons plays like a very safe kind of Simmons. Maybe more so than Simmons. There was a lot of little like funny side parts. I don't know the name of the actor. I assume they're all comedians, and I mean, you know, well-known comedians in their own way. But I like the sort of the Marine veteran who's constantly scared about like the dumbest things, and he's like constantly trying to hit on Sarah. I thought he was like a fun kind of small part. You know, Simmons is a fun small part. He does kind of at the end, you know, which is, it kind of makes sense from his perspective, Simmons' perspective. You know, he's saying, why would I necessarily pass up? Why not come to accept the fact that I'm living like one of the best days I'll have in my life with my loving, attractive wife, my two kids that are both healthy and loving and, you know, love me as their dad. Like, okay, so I want to see them, you know, grow old and go through like some of the things you like to see your kids go through. But at the same time, like, I also want to have to move on to like the sucky parts. I don't know, when the kids become annoying teenagers or when, you know, the son starts doing drugs or whatever it is, you know? So there's something about Simmons. I mean, again, this goes into some of the kind of life philosophy of the movie. There's something about Simmons' acceptance, which is obviously very different than Sandberg's acceptance, which really was very appealing. You know, he gets to like live the best day. He gets to live one of the best parts of his life over and over and over. You know, what's to hate?
Yeah. I mean, he has that wistfulness that that you mentioned of, you know, he's not going to get to see his kids grow up or see what happens next. But, you know, I guess, you know, he's just come to accept his reality because what other choice does he have other than to just accept it and live with it?
I think the movie just sort of understands there's a human instinct for progress. There's a human instinct to move forward, even if moving forward is going to be worse. And like other movies engage this, you know, sometimes when the characters are in like a safe oasis and they say like, why leave here and why press on to the desert, on to the next leg of the journey? And they say, because, you know, because we must press on. We must like test our will. We must see if going on will like get us out of here or something, as opposed to just sort of staying at this point in the journey. So I guess that's just sort of a human instinct we're supposed to accept, because intuitively, there's something somewhat appealing outside of, I guess, the psychological burden, as you're saying, of Simmons knowing he's kind of going to be redoing this day ad infinitum. You know, the loneliness of that, I guess, could be crushing and overwhelming, even if kind of the reality of every day can be very pleasant. That's all I have on Palm Springs.
Let's move to Classics Corner. Aaron, give us your quick favorite classic that you saw in the last 30 plus days.
Definitely. This is much harder for me, but I'm going to go with one that maybe everybody has seen, but it led me down a path that's been very rewarding. And it's from 1962. It's Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, starring Betty Davis and Joan Crawford. And I'm going to cheat a little bit and recommend the FX show Feud, which was outstanding to watch after seeing this movie. It dives into the whole rivalry between Betty Davis and Joan Crawford. But overall, the movie just is, you could kind of view it as a B movie, but I think it's a super high quality film. I really, really liked it. The last hour, my eyebrows were like glued to the top of my head because I really didn't know how far Betty Davis was going to go with it. And I really respect.
Why did you see this movie?
I had seen All About Eve. And I decided to go on a Betty Davis deep dive, and I was like, oh, this movie looks really right up my alley. I like kind of dark horror, and I was just like, this movie, I had never really heard about it. So I'd only been vaguely familiar with the feud between Betty Davis and Joan Crawford.
Will, remember when I told you Odd History is about to be made on There Will Be Pod, so I hope you have something special to bring this you know, maybe some special SFX sounds at this moment. Remember I told you that I saw a classic horror movie this month for our Classic Corner, but there was another reason besides? Well, the movie I saw this month for Classics Corner was Whatever Happened to Baby Jane.
Whoa!
Completely randomly. But I have a better reason than you, Aaron. So
are we in a time loop right now?
I know. Wait, listen to my reason. So my reason is that I'm not one of those people who's such a, you know, knowledgeable or pretends to be savvy about Hollywood history. I don't listen to Hollywood history type podcasts. You know, I don't read the book so much. You know, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is about as much as I'll go. So I'm not making any pretensions to that. And, you know, so when these people die, like, you know, the Kirk Douglases out there, it doesn't have a tremendous impact on me. But when an actress of yesteryear named Olivia de Havilland did die this past month, so I was like, oh, I never really heard of her whatsoever. And I was like, let me check out her film oeuvre, And I figured I would just see one of her movies. So I figured, okay, I'll see the last significant film she was in. And the last significant film she was in is a movie called Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte. So I looked up Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte, and I saw that it's the sequel to a movie called Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. And that Whatever Happened to Baby Jane is considered the better of the two. Sorry, Dee Haviland, but you were, as Aaron can tell you, Dee Haviland was brought in, as they tell you in Feud. I think she's also a character in Feud. She's played by Catherine Zeta-Jones. Talk about the Douglases. So, you know, she was brought in into the sequel, Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte, because of the feud between the two leads and Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. So I decided I was going to do my homework. I was going to watch Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. Then, I was going to watch Feud. And then I was going to watch Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte. And Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte was going to be my classics corner. What happened? I liked Feud a lot. It's a great TV show, and I second everything Aaron said. Whatever Happened to Baby Jane is a trash movie. It's a trash movie. And I thought I was rolling with Aaron when he said, you know, at most he can call this a B-level movie. And then I completely disagree with him when he says, but this is incredible. And I'll leave it at this. If you look on Wikipedia, yes, that's the extent often of my film research. When you look at Wikipedia and you look at the way it says Whatever Happened to Baby Jane was received when it came out, critics ripped it apart. They said, this is like a C-level knockoff of Hitchcock. This is just like bad camera, overacting at the worst of Betty Davis. You know, and you look at the reviews then, and I read the Wikipedia article after I saw the movie, and I was like, yes, this is exactly what I thought. This looks like D-level Hitchcock. The way the camera like zooms in, the way the characters in the movie are just incredibly dumb. You know, the way that you see the plot coming, you see the ending, you know, in the first scene, and not because they tell you, just because everything is so, so telecast. I mean, just to give you a sense, this is a movie like where a character throws a piece of paper outside of her window, and then like the camera like zooms in on where the paper is on the ground, and then it like zooms out, and then it like zooms back in, just to sort of give you three chances to notice the fact that she threw a piece. It's really, really B-level in that way, and I don't think it's doing that in sort of like a B-level horror. I think it's doing that because they thought that was like, you know, impressive camera work or something at the time. So I was completely bored. I had to force myself to the ending. And the long and short of it is that I disliked it so much, I decided to skip the sequel. So sorry, I never saw the sequel. All I did was Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. I would strongly recommend that people do not see it. Will, I'll see another horror movie in your respect, but this one didn't do it for me. That's all I got.
I've never seen that. I've never seen it, but just to close the loop on the podcast extended universe, this movie came up on the podcast I do with your brother, Sammy, with Alexander on our Curb Your Enthusiasm podcast, because in the episode called Porno Guild, there's like a crazy woman and Larry refers to her as Baby Jane. And I guess that references the movie, but I didn't get it at the time, but maybe you guys get that.
Yeah. I mean, I think any Betty Davis role for several decades was sort of a crazy person. But yeah, Aaron could speak to Betty Davis's filmography far more than myself. I'm done with Classics Corner for July.
Okay. Well, I'm about to make There Will Be Pod history here, because the movie I watched for Classics Corner was, drum roll, Twins.
I thought you were going to say a movie that came out like December 31st, 2019.
this is the Danny DeVito Arnold Schwarzenegger movie.
Yes, Daniel DeVito and Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Amazing. Let's hear.
So, Twins is a movie about these two brothers, twins actually, who reunite, and they try to find their birth mother. I thought it was much better than I was expecting. I'd always heard people like joke about Twins as like the, you know, the shitty Arnold Schwarzenegger, Danny DeVito movie. But I honestly laughed several times. I thought Schwarzenegger gives like his best comedic performance I've seen from him. Danny DeVito played Danny DeVito, and it was very entertaining. So, you know, if you haven't seen Twins, it's on HBO Max. I recommend.
So you can't see it.
Yeah, so you can see it.
It's a 90s movie, right? Mid-90s?
88.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, it feels like a 90s movie, though.
Yeah. Far, far before your time, Will, so that's a deep classic.
Yeah, I know.
You really have to reach into the memory bank there. Av, how about you?
Yeah, I'm gonna be very liberal with the use of classic here. I did just watch this week the entire Back to the Future trilogy with my daughter. So that was very exciting. But the classic corner pick for me is going to be The Other Guys, the Mark Wahlberg, Will Ferrell joints from 2010. And I went in kind of expecting, all right, this is probably going to be stupid, but like whatever. I was in the mood to kind of just like turn my brain off and laugh a little bit. And I was like really pleasantly surprised by it. It was really fun. Will Ferrell plays this like incredible straight man character that, you know, obviously he doesn't normally play. He's usually the goofball character. An incredible cast. Samuel L. Jackson's in it. The Rock is in it. Just like the first like half hour of this movie, I was like almost rolling on the floor. I thought it was like so funny. And then it kind of loses a little bit of steam, but there's still what to like about the rest of it. So,
did you watch this in preparation for Eurovision, the movie?
I just watched it because it was on Netflix.
Oh, okay. I thought you were doing a Will Ferrell renaissance or something like that.
No, that's Will Ferrell movie tournament. That should be our next bracket.
You can edit this whole thing out because I think any reference to Eurovision as a movie that came out in 2020 only cheapens the year, if that's even possible at this point. So, but probably best not to mention it. I remember seeing that when it came out, and I really liked it then, and I imagine it would be just as enjoyable now. So, high marks. I think I give Av best classic corner of July. I think Aaron and I have nullified each other. We sort of bombed each other out of existence with his pro and my con. Sorry, Aaron.
It's okay. Don't worry. If there's anything I don't mind, it's disagreeing on movie opinions.
I'm completely shocked that was, you know, because particularly Aaron, you are, you are a classicist. Similar
classics. Oh, not quite. I'm learning all these classics as we go here. Like I'm just like, you know, I just am discovering them. And honestly, I am becoming one by the month though, especially in quarantine.
Yeah, it's fascinating that of the 30 classic movies you saw in July and the first few days of August, this is what you picked. So, you know, there is, I imagine, a Yiddish term for this coincidence, but I'll give it to the power of Palm Springs. Maybe if we had a physicist on, he could explain this.
Maybe.
Yeah. Perhaps Aaron? Dr. Chester, if you're still awake, it was good speaking to you guys this month. What do we have? Do we have a big Chris Nolan movie in September?
I think everything is just so up in the air. I don't know if anything's coming out next month.
The only movie I'm excited for is this Seth Rogen movie where he's in the pickle ride. Yeah.
Yeah.
That looks great. Apparently, New Mutants is supposed to finally come out.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I'm sure it will. I can't wait.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. So we may get our pick along in a month's time. So we'll see. But speak to you guys then, okay?
All right.
Yeah. Good talking to you. Okay.
Thanks for having me on. Yeah, for sure. The second hand unwind. If you're